Okay, thanks comrades. I believe Lenin actually said that the two most complicated issues for any sort of Marxist to understand is Marxist economics and the national question. And we've managed this weekend to actually do both of these particular subjects. Now, the national question is really a vast, complex subject. And I can only really sort of try and summarise the main points. And I've tried to keep it as simple as possible, largely probably for my own benefit, but also as well, I think it's one of these subjects that to try and explain things, you have to do it in a reasonably simple way. So my lead-off is going to be to first of all look at how the nation-states have historically evolved. I'm going to go through the history of things and the evolution of the nation-state. Then I'm going to be looking at bourgeois nationalism. I'm going to be looking at one or two countries to use as an example of nationalism, and then obviously I'll conclude. Now, today we think of the nation state as something natural. That's what most people think. The nation state is something natural. It's always been there. It's always been there in the past, and it'll always be there in the future. The world is divided at the moment to around over 300 countries, nation states, and it really does appear that the whole of human history has been, apart from the earliest times, have been organised within nation states. But the fact is that the nation state as we know today is actually relatively modern creation, and it's only really been around for just over 200 years. Now, with the exception of England and Holland, who had their bourgeois revolutions earlier than most other countries, as I say, the most other advanced nation states have only been around for just over 200 years. Now, prior to that time, over 200 years, there was actually no nations, as I say, as we know today. There were mainly tribes, city-states, and empires. So the nation state is a historically evolved entity, which I say has not always existed and will not necessarily, for that very reason, exist in the future. In reality, the nation state is a product of capitalism. It was established by the bourgeoisie as it was a necessity for the development of capitalism, which I'll be coming on to shortly. Now, as we all know here, feudal society predated capitalism. And feudalism was a society which basically was based on the ownership of land, and the local lord who controlled the local economy and his, the local laws and his own territory. And there were local taxes, there were toll roads, there were separate money systems, there was even separate weights and measures. And Allen, in his document, Marxism and the National Question, which I would very much recommend, quotes a historian, Robert Heilbronner, who graphically describes a German merchant going about his business around 1550, which I think very clearly describes what feudalism was like. The merchant, bearded and fur-coated, is coming back to his home in Baden. He writes to his wife that he has visited 30 markets and is troubled with saddle burn. He is even more troubled by the nuisances of the times. As he travels, he is stopped approximately once every 10 miles to pay a custom toll between Basel and Cologne. He pays 31 levies. And that is not all. Each community he visits has its own money, its own rules and regulations, its own law and order. In the area around Baden alone, there are 112 different measures of length, 92 different square measures for cereals, and 123 for liquids, 63 for liquor, and 80 different pound weights. That was the situation in Germany around 1550. And in the Middle Ages, European states were present in sort of outline, but not in the way the nation states are today. And even national wars were not really national in character. They were really feudalistic. They were supported by local lords. They were headed by medieval kings and queens. And the real aim of these wars was really the protection and ownership of land, or the conquest of other lands. And the soldiers who actually fought in these wars really had more allegiance to the local lord, because they were really protecting the interests of the local lord, than they were even to the King of England or of France. So it was only gradually and very painfully, over a period of several centuries, did a national consciousness actually arise. And of course, the decay of feudalism and the rise of absolute monarchies and the rise of the sort of early capitalists and merchants clearly accelerated the whole process. And just to quote Robert Heilbronner again, first there was a gradual emergence of national political units in Europe. Under the blows of peasant wars and kingly conquests, the isolated existence of early feudalism gave way to centralised monarchies. And with monarchies came the growth of the national spirit. In turn, this meant royal patronage for favoured industries, etc. The infinity of rules and regulations which plagued, and the merchant I was just talking about, and his fellow 16th century travelling merchants, gave way to national laws, common measurements, and more or less standard currencies. So the overthrow of these sort of local peculiarities that I've been describing, as you can imagine, must have been a nightmare for new emerging capitalists. That was a huge, giant step forward for society at that time. And of course, feudal society was decaying, and we had this embryonic capitalism which was developing. But at that stage, we couldn't truly talk about a national market or a nation state, because the conditions just weren't quite right for capitalism to develop. If capitalism was going to develop, it had to break down these local restrictions and these local peculiarities. And they had to create a national home market using similar standards and weights. And they had to politically unite territories so they had the same laws. You couldn't have capitalism thriving when you've got one law in this particular area, and you go along and you've got another law in this particular area, or different weights and measures. As you can try and get a picture of that, it just seems absolutely crazy. Fine for feudalism, totally hopeless for the rise of capitalism. So of course, the nation state is a form which best suited capitalism and capitalist relations, which was completely different and distinguished from the form which suited feudalism, which was very much around local economy. And of course, the nation state is a form which allowed the bourgeoisie the freest, the widest, and the speediest development of capitalism. So that lies, in summary, the economic foundation for the creation of the nation state. It was established by the bourgeois, who required a national market, and it was very much profound economic factors which underlie the urge towards a nation state. But the nation state was not achieved peacefully or without struggle. The capitalists, of course, had to overthrow the feudal system and the feudal ruling class to achieve its historic aims. As we always say, no ruling class goes out of history without a fight. And of course, the feudalistic class was no different. So of course, the bourgeoisie then had to carry out its own bourgeois revolution. And the very first European nation, Holland, was formed in the 16th century. And that was a result of a bourgeois revolutionary war of national liberation against Spain. The US bourgeois revolution was a war of national liberation in the 18th century. In Italy, it was through wars of independence. In Germany, it was Bismarck went to war to unify Germany. In England, it was a civil war in the 16th century, 17th century. I always get that one wrong. And in Scotland, we've not actually had a bourgeois revolution. So I'll move on very quickly on that one. But of course, initially, the rise of capitalism ran parallel alongside the decay of feudalism. And this led to, obviously, a direct conflict with the feudal system, as I've explained. So feudalism had to be overthrown for capitalism to survive. But, of course, the bourgeoisie on its own cannot possibly do that. The bourgeoisie is actually, a few people, just like the ruling class today, in comparison to the population, are a few people. The bourgeoisie could not overthrow the feudal ruling class on its own. To conquer power, the bourgeois was forced to put itself forward as the representatives of the people, and that is the whole people, the nation. So they put themselves in England as the representatives of the English people. In France, it was the French people. And of course, when you actually think about that, they have to do that. They can't possibly do it on their own. They have to win the support of the whole people. And if you look throughout the whole world where there's been final victories for capitalism, they have always been linked to national movements where the bourgeois have actually won the support of the whole people around national movements. And the first principle of the French Revolution, for instance, was political and economic centralisation under the banner of the Republic, one and indivisible. The French Revolution, of course, united France for the first time into one nation, and again swept aside all the local peculiarities, of course, that there were in France. And of course, the French Revolution, the big message there was the Declaration of the Rights of Man, and the rallying call was to end the feudal and the oppression by the monarchy. And of course, in the French Revolution, just like most all bourgeois revolutions, it was all about abolishing privilege and universal rights, many of which, of course, was not implemented. But slavery was abolished, for instance, in the French colonies. So the bourgeois had to win the support of the people, and of course, one of the ways that they did that was rallying calls about ending oppression, etc., etc. Now, the French feudal in the French Revolution, just the same in all other bourgeois revolutions, feudal dues to nobles ended. The feudal legal system was abolished, the church's influence was curbed, all classes legally had to pay taxes, internal tariff barriers removed, town oligarchies were abolished. And that was repeated in most European countries. So, of course, the bourgeois revolution in all these countries was led by the bourgeois for its own interests, but it had to introduce and include certain democratic demands as well to win over the population. So basically, bourgeois revolutions were carried out from below by revolutionary means, by the people, inspired by the promise of freedom from serfdom. And if you can imagine, that must have been a huge rallying call in feudal society, where people were just ground down by the feudal system. So basically, by the latter half of the 19th century, the national question in Europe was largely solved by bourgeois revolutions. And between 1789 and 1871 really were the periods of sort of national movements and the creation of nation states. And of course, this was a new and progressive period for society. There were democratic demands and democratic advances for society, and it opened the gates, of course, for a massive development of productive forces, and of course the creation of capitalism's own gravedigger, the modern working class. But interestingly, such was the speed of the development of the productive forces that by really the end of the 19th century, capitalism and the productive forces were already beginning to outgrow the narrow limitations of the nation state. So the nation states were set up for capitalism to give them a local market, but by the end of the 19th century, even that was insufficient because of the massive development of the productive forces. And of course, the national markets within all these given countries could not absorb the commodities that their local capitalists could produce. And of course, as we know, that led directly to imperialism and to wars between the major powers, who have since then been in conquest and fighting each other for more markets. Now, the national question has a long, long history within Marxism. Marx, Engels and Lenin wrote extensively on the national question. And it's always, and still to this day, it's always been viewed as a powerful and important issue for the working class and the international working class. And it cannot be ignored without potentially serious consequences for the international working class. Now, the first international was actually embroiled by the whole issue of the national question. And Marx actually at the time... Marx at the time said about the First International, "Yesterday there was a discussion on the International Council on the present war. The discussion wound up, as was to be expected, with the question of nationality in general and the attitude we take towards it." So it's no new subject. This has been around for a very, very long time, and it's been a difficult subject for socialists and Marxists. And of course, one of the contradictions of the present epoch is that at a time when the nation state is completely and woefully showing its limitations, the national question is still a festering chronic problem in many countries throughout the world. But Marx and Engels and Lenin believed that the national question must be considered by taking into account two key requirements. The first one is that the national question must never be subordinated to the labour question. And what they mean by that is the national question must always be considered exclusively from the point of interest, from the point of view of the working class in any given country and of the working class internationally. So it must subordinate itself to nothing else but that. And this is particularly important, that the national question must be examined within definite historical limits. An account must be taken of specific features within given countries, which might be different to other features. Now, what that is basically saying is that we cannot have one big formula about the national question and we apply it to this country and we apply it to that country and we apply it to the next country. This actually is what makes the national question very difficult, because we have to consider the national question and its particular form and its particular features in the historic situation in any given country, and taking into account the features as well of any given country or other aspects around that particular question. So basically, Marx and Engels and Lenin constantly viewed the national question as they had a flexible position on it, and they always approached it from the standpoint of the general interests of the working class and of the international revolution. Now, I think truly understanding the dialectics which surround the national question is not easy, and it has tripped up many a revolutionary party. And I've been involved in politics and been reading reasonably much about politics for probably 30 years, and I know, and I can honestly say, until I actually have put so much effort into this particular subject to do today, I think probably I can say that I've got a reasonable grasp of it. I don't think I properly understood it before, so it is actually quite a difficult subject, and it really does trip people up. But that the foundation and the first principles to understand it, I believe, is around these two requirements I said earlier. If you start from these first principles, that puts you in a good step forward. Now, the two most common important situations where the Marxists and the Labour movement need a correct position around the national question are at times of war or potential war, or when we have to consider supporting a national movement of a given country, for instance Ireland, Scotland, the Basques, Palestine or whatever. These are the two most common situations where having a correct position on the national question is really important. Well, one of the first things you have to consider is defining what is actually a nation. You know, again, we think we sort of understand what a nation is, but what actually is a nation? It's not actually as easy as it first appears. Now, Stalin wrote a pamphlet on the national question, and it's widely believed that he worked closely with Lenin at the time. It was widely believed it was Lenin that actually wrote it, but it's got Stalin's name on it. And he defined a nation as, a nation is a historically evolved, stable community of language, territory, economic life and psychological makeup manifested in a community of culture. There you go. I think that's a generally accepted definition, but it is only a generalisation. In real life, of course, there are variants which contradict this. Take language as an example. Now, it would seem obvious the importance of having a similar language in any given nation. That would be obvious. You would have one language. It would appear to be like a distinguishing mark of a nation to share the same language. And Trotsky expressed the importance of language of a nation state. Trotsky wrote, "It is a most important instrument of human communication and consequently of industry. It becomes national together with the triumph of commodity exchange, which integrates nations. Upon this foundation, the national state is erected as the most convenient, profitable and normal arena for the play of capitalist relations." So that might be true, but of course there's exceptions to this rule. Take Switzerland as an example. Switzerland's considered a nation of reasonably long standing, but there's actually no common language in Switzerland. There's three state languages, and apparently if they have to put a law to a referendum, it has to be published in five languages. So the key to understanding the national question, which I'll come back time and time again, is that a nation is a historically evolved identity, and each nation has got its own peculiarities in terms of how it has been historically evolved, and it does not always conform to these formal definitions, because dialectics really starts from an analysis of living processes, of things as they develop, change and evolve, and the national question is one subject which I think a dialectical approach is absolutely essential, otherwise you fall down a big hole. So what's clear is that a nation isn't actually something fixed or static either. That's another thing to think of. A nation is fixed and static. Nations can be created where none have existed before, and of course that's how nations started in the first place when you actually think about it. Nations can disintegrate, causing fragmentation, for instance, in national consciousness. Maybe India is an example of that, where in a given nation state where the bourgeois can offer absolutely no way out for the masses, you end up having fragmentation, you end up having conflicts, and you end up having disintegration of nations. So what was yesterday a nation is not necessarily tomorrow a nation. And also, what was yesterday an oppressed nation is not necessarily an oppressed nation tomorrow. Nations could be transformed from oppressed nations to monstrously oppressive nations and imperialist states. The USA is probably a good example of that. That was a colony of the UK, of Britain. Now it's a monstrous imperialist state which goes around and oppresses half the world. So when we consider the national question, as I've said, we don't analyse it formally but dialectically, and we must consider each situation as it has developed and how it is developing. And as I say, they must always be grounded on the interests of the working class. Now, the rights of nations to self-determination, thing that we've all heard of and I'm sure all read about. And one of the most misunderstood and undialectical approaches to the national question is the application of this particular democratic demand. And it is a democratic demand, not a revolutionary demand. This demand, the rights of nations to self-determination, which basically says to any nation, we support your right to control your own affairs, even if it means separating off and becoming an independent state. We support your right to that, if that's what you want. And this demand was absolutely decisive. It wasn't just important in the Russian Revolution, it was decisive. Because with that demand in the Russian Revolution, where the Bolsheviks promised all the different minorities, minority nationalities, they promised them the right to succeed if that's what they wanted, because they had been completely oppressed by the great Russian Tsarist government. Because the Bolsheviks believed, quite rightly, that if you did not allow these national minorities, if you did not give them the right to self-determination, then what in effect you're doing is you're supporting the privileges of the dominant nation. So if you're in a situation where one country's oppressed, you've got the oppressor, and you do not allow the oppressed nation the right to self-determination, you're basically saying, well, status quo's okay, you know. And that's what that meant in practice. But it was part of a class programme. It wasn't part of a bourgeois programme. It was part of the Bolshevik class, independent class policy, not a petty bourgeois policy. That's the complete difference.